Reading to Altoona, York to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, data centers and the energy needed to power them are critical to American dominance in the field of artificial intelligence. Carl Marrera from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to discuss. In an era of global communications, practicing medicine across state lines can get a healthcare professional into big trouble. The Pacific Legal Foundation is taking action. Kathy Hoekstra is here with details. And the military conflict with Iran is not the only factor driving up gas prices. The antiquated Jones Act is also making energy more expensive. Emily Bry of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Carl Marrera of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The Foundation for Government Accountability has issued a report that shows welfare fraud in Pennsylvania jumped by 165% over the past year. That gives Penns Woods the fourth highest fraud rate in the nation. The data is found in the FBI's National Incident-Based Reporting System, which tracks welfare fraud. The cost to we, the taxpayer, could become significant, as under a new federal law, if a state's Medicaid error rate exceeds 3%, the federal government will stop matching spending above that threshold. That leaves taxpayers on the hook for the remaining cost. Despite additional billions of dollars each year poured into K-12 education in Pennsylvania, students in at least one school in Philadelphia are begging for working bathrooms and dealing with mouse and cockroach infestations. The kids are trapped in such conditions while Governor Josh Shapiro and legislative Democrats continue working to cut funds for the school choice options that would give students a pathway out of that squalor. Election integrity remains a big issue, and the Pennsylvania Department of State, which oversees elections, is spending millions on a new voter registration system. However, the department is refusing to release details on the progress of the system's development, telling Spotlight Pennsylvania that making such information public would pose a, quote, security risk. No explanation as to the impact such a lack of transparency might have on public confidence in the new system. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. A number of new data centers are being built in Pennsylvania, and that has generated both controversy and a wave of misinformation. Here to discuss the importance of developing these centers is Carl Marrera. He is executive director of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and he joins us now to discuss data centers, energy, and artificial intelligence. Carl, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Carl, when we talk about the data centers that are being proposed in Pennsylvania, and there are numerous of them that are being proposed, this, of course, has generated a lot of controversy. And among the issues is the amount of energy that these data centers are going to take and the number of jobs that may be created as a result of it. But you had an interesting point in an op-ed that you wrote recently about how many of the components that go into these data centers are, in fact, made in Pennsylvania, and we are exporting elsewhere, and perhaps we should just keep them here. I want to give us some background on that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first of all, thanks for having me. I think that we find ourselves in Pennsylvania with this data center, these data center projects, in a very familiar position. I mean, Pennsylvania has always kind of been the state that builds the stuff that makes other stuff. And you can trace that back to the timber industry. You can trace that to the metals industry, specifically with iron and steel. And more recently, to the natural gas industry, where you can actually extract some of the byproducts from the natural gas that is the feedstock for modern plastics. Well, what's going to drive modern industry from here? And that is obviously technology. And Pennsylvania is already on the forefront of that. Let's back up a little bit and try to put it in this perspective. So we talk about the cloud all the time. And, you know, you save things to the cloud, you stream things from the cloud. And I don't think that people really truly understand what the cloud is. The cloud is not abstract. The cloud is not water vapor hanging above our heads in the atmosphere. The cloud is actually very, very physical. The cloud is made of switches and gear and wires, cabling, aggregate, and it's housed in very, very large buildings with a lot of really complex equipment. Pennsylvania has been making a lot of the equipment that is necessary for what is the modern quote-unquote cloud for quite some time. And because of the data center investment that we're seeing on the East Coast, mainly it's occurring in Virginia, but right now Pennsylvania manufacturers are investing tens, hundreds of millions of dollars in expansion to create the products that go into these data center warehouses. Well, transporting goods and services like that is money. So all eyes are on Pennsylvania right now to see if we could actually replicate what's happening in Virginia and some of the other states with data centers right here in Pennsylvania, where a lot of that stuff is already being made. It makes a lot of sense. And also then you have the energy aspect that you referenced. And that's something that Pennsylvania has always done really well. We have powered all of the plants through all of the different generations and all of those evolutions of industry that I mentioned earlier, whether that was timber, that required a lot of energy, different kind of energy, but it required a lot of energy. Same for steel and iron, same for natural gas, although natural gas is an energy source in and of itself. But we have a lot of energy that can and should be deployed in Pennsylvania. It's going to be market forces that are going to keep the with the increased demand, there's going to need to be an increased supply. And because we are a competitive market state, I absolutely think that competitive markets work and that energy will absolutely be available. And because of an increased demand and you get increased supply, that should actually lower energy costs for Pennsylvanians because, you know, more supply coming online, more baseload capacity, especially utilizing our natural gas assets, should actually lower the energy costs for consumers, not raise them.
Opposition to these data centers based on energy usage, Carl, it generally assumes that energy is a finite product. We only have so much of it. And the question is, how do we divide it up? What you seem to be saying is we have a lot more capacity. And if you look at some of the data centers that are already in the development and about to come online, both with near the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant in Indiana County, it appears that the data center industry is finding a way to provide its own energy.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't anything new. Yeah, interestingly, there's a plant up in Northeast PA and in the manufacturing industry. And some years ago, they drilled a natural gas well on site. Manufacturers have been deploying what's called combined heat and power for a very long time. And what combined heat and power is it's essentially a small power plant on the site of a manufacturing plant that provides energy for that manufacturer through electricity, but then also you can use some of the other byproducts, whether that be steam or heat, in the manufacturing process itself. Data centers are really no different. And we're seeing probably the biggest example in the world happening here in Pennsylvania in Indiana County at the Homer City site that used to be a coal-fired facility that was shuttered under the Obama Clean Power Plan rules. And when Pennsylvania was still operating as though it was going to enter the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which I know is a whole nother topic for another show and really has been covered many times by this outlet. But that plant was going to go under. Instead, a natural gas well is being drilled on that site to create a new combined cycle power plant, probably the largest natural gas fired power plant on the East Coast. And there's going to be a data center that is built next to it. There's going to be enough electricity generated to actually sell a third of what they're producing back into the grid as baseload capacity. That can be replicated. And it should be replicated. And it's something that, again, is not a new concept. It's something that manufacturers have been doing for a long time. When Pennsylvania was abundantly reliant on coal, a lot of the combined cycle power plants on manufacturing sites were coal-fired. And a lot of those have come offline and have been replaced by Pennsylvania natural gas. Cuts emissions by 60%, lower cost, which ultimately means that it's more competitive for those manufacturers. That's what we can and should be seeing with these data centers, where they're kind of creating their own power based on market forces on site, selling the excess back into the grid. And again, that should lower prices for everyday energy consumers like you and me.
We are talking with Carl Marrera, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, about energy and data centers, the number of data centers being proposed for various locations around Pennsylvania. Carl, one of the other concerns that get raised at the local level, and I think to a large degree, most of these concerns have become really somewhat overblown because of the fact that this has come upon us rather suddenly, or at least into the public consciousness rather suddenly. What about the impact locally on local infrastructure, local tax structure? How do the data centers impact folks at the local level?
Well, ultimately, these are huge real estate projects disguised as energy quote-unquote problems. But I think we've dispelled a lot of the myths surrounding those energy problems. But from the local level, this is a jobs creator. And, you know, we hear the opposition all the time that, you know, these data centers are only going to employ 25 people full-time once they're built. But these are 4, 5, 6 year construction projects. And then we get the same pushback. Well, you know, those 1,000 construction jobs are only temporary. Well, all construction jobs are temporary. You build the thing and then you move on and build another thing. But these are really, really big things that are going to employ a lot of people for a long, long time. But look, across Pennsylvania, it's no secret. There are towns, there are communities, municipalities that are struggling. Towns that lose their manufacturer are towns that lose their town. And we've seen that time and time again, particularly in Western Pennsylvania with the erosion of some of the metals industries, and also in Northeast PA. But those locations are the ones that actually have the access to the raw material of energy, mainly through natural gas, that could benefit the most from expansion and build out of these data centers, employing thousands of people over several years to construct these things. But again, to go back to the original point of the cloud is not abstract, the cloud is physical. Mitsubishi Electric Power they actually expanded their plant capacity by $90 million that they're manufacturing switchgear that's needed for all of these different data center projects. And that's in Beaver County. There was a $353 million battery factory in Warrendale, PA that's relocating its headquarters to the Pittsburgh region to support this industry. GE Verona had a $100 million investment in a factory out there to create some of the gear that goes into the data centers. Westinghouse Electric in Butler County, an $80 billion nuclear reactor agreement. Hitachi Energy, $70 million facility in Westmoreland County. Coherent in Armstrong County, $2 billion agreement with one of the largest chip makers in the world. These things are happening in Pennsylvania. These investments are sustaining communities, whether you know it or not. And we haven't even mentioned the property tax benefits that these projects can have. Data centers are very large. I mean, I'll give you that. They do take up a large amount of space. But because they can't build vertically, they have to build out. That requires a lot of property. And in turn, that property is much higher value with that data center being built on it, which results in massive amounts of property taxes that really is the lifeblood that sustains our school districts training the next generation of workforce. So yes, of course there are concerns, but looking at it holistically, once again, this is an industry that is going to power the next generation of industry, and it's happening here in Pennsylvania.
And if it doesn't happen here in Pennsylvania, Carl, is this a battle that we are fighting to stay ahead of the Chinese in terms of not only data centers, but artificial intelligence itself?
Yeah, not just China, India. You also, because they are energy intensive, have a host of competitors in throughout the Middle East. While the cloud is very physical, the cloud is not necessarily dependent on location. So to have access to those streaming services, to the AI searches, to any Google search, it doesn't necessarily have to happen in the United States or, I mean, Pennsylvania for that matter. It can happen globally.
Carl Marrera is executive director of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. A lot of research has gone into this topic. Carl, tell us a bit about PMA. Obviously, PMA on our program quite often. Tell us what you do and where can folks go online to access a lot of the data that you've talked about today?
Sure. And again, thanks for having me. The Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is the not-for-profit statewide organization that represents all of the different people who make all of the different things throughout Pennsylvania. It's $111 billion in gross state product, about 12% of our total gross state product year over year. And you can find us at www.pamanufacturers.org.
Carl Marrera of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. Carl, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
California is among those states that make it illegal for medical professionals to consult or practice across state lines or through cyber consulting. The Pacific Legal Foundation is challenging one such law. Kathy Hoekstra finds out more from Dr. Sean McBride, an oncologist at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Kathy?
We live in a world where you can FaceTime someone across the globe in seconds. But in California, a doctor doing the exact same thing while caring for a patient can mean big trouble. Yes, really. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me now is Dr. Sean McBride, a national renowned radiation oncologist and an American hero who is fighting for Californians' rights to telehealth care, no matter where their doctors live or work. Welcome, Dr. McBride. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, okay, so let's just get it right out of the gate. You're based in New York. So why are California's telehealth restrictions a problem for you and patients?
That's a great question. So I work at a very large cancer center, an academic medical center. We treat patients from all over the country. And as you can imagine, California being one of the larger states, we have a lot of patients from California that come to us for treatment. And I will oftentimes consult for patients in California, both after their initial cancer diagnosis to help them understand what treatment options might be there. And if they come to New York for treatment, as part of the follow-up, we'll often do quick check-ins. And traveling from California to New York for those quick check-ins for a patient recovering from cancer treatment can be quite burdensome. And obviously, at their initial diagnosis, they want to gather as much information as they can. And traveling to New York when you have an initial cancer diagnosis, that can be burdensome. So an informational call with an oncologist at where I work, Memorial Sloan Kettering, can be quite helpful for the patient and really reduces the burden.
Okay. And then California's telehealth restrictions, however, require an out-of-state doctor to be licensed in the state of California just for the ability to log on like you and I are doing right now, right?
Absolutely. California's telehealth licensure laws require that I be licensed in California. And just as an aside, the licensure requirements for California basically mirror New York's licensure requirements. So it's not like California is requiring additional information above and beyond what I've already demonstrated in New York and what I've already done. But just for an informational call, just for a pure conversation, they consider that the practice of medicine and it requires full licensure. And absent that full licensure, even though I'm fully licensed in New York State, and absent that, it's a criminal act.
Yeah, that's one of the crazy things. Violator, if you get caught talking to a patient in New York via Zoom or something, you could face up to $10,000 in fines or prison time. I mean, criminalizing doctor-patient care is, you know, morally outrageous. That really gives you pause. You know, a government in California is dictating, putting up barriers for patients to access specialty care like yours that is really specialized. There aren't a lot of people in the country who are doing the stuff that you do.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that, you know, at big cancer centers like Memorial Sloan Kettering, we have a lot of clinical trials that are only offered at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So it's critical for patients who are newly diagnosed with cancer, especially sometimes rare, less common cancers, to be able to access that information from us and talk directly to us to understand whether they might be eligible for those trials. And yeah, California creates barriers to us successfully doing that.
Absolutely. And anybody who is listening, I'm sure most people are touched by cancer in some way, shape, or form. Both of my parents passed away from cancer, and everybody knows that that takes an awful lot of follow-up care, consultation, you know, the monitoring progress, developments, and things like that. So, this is really, really critical stuff. But so in addition, though, to just limiting the patient's access to specialty care like yours, California's telehealth regime, again, criminalizes protected medical speech, discriminates against outside expertise, and imposes unjustifiable burdens on patients and physicians alike. So now, with free representation by Pacific Legal Foundation, you, along with a Californian, her name is Shelley Horowitz, who has a really rare type of hemophilia, and her experts who treat her are out of state as well. You and Shelley are suing California regulators in federal court. So why this case? Why now? And a lot of people might be wondering, why don't you just bite the bullet and get a California medical license?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I can take the third question first. You know, Obviously there's an expense component to getting a California license, both the upfront cost and the continuing cost. But you magnify, for those of us who treat patients across, where they come all from all 50 states to Memorial Sloan Kettering for us to be able to treat them, you can imagine that it's not just the imposition from California. You magnify that nationally for every state, and it becomes, number one, a substantial financial burden, but also a substantial administrative burden to keep track of when all of these things are due. It takes a lot of time and effort on the part of the physicians. And you can imagine that these laws apply not just to California residents, but when an individual travels into California, which oftentimes patients will do who live in New York, California's law technically restricts my ability to speak to them as well. So, you know, it's the location of the patient that dictates where the practice of medicine is occurring. So if I had to keep track of where all my patients, maybe they're going to California for 3 months over the summer. Does that mean it is criminal for me to communicate with my patient for 3 months over the summer while they're in California? Maybe they spend half their year in California. Do I have to keep track of that to understand whether or not I have to re-up my licensure? I mean, it's just a substantial burden. And in addition to that, it creates a conflict between our professional obligations to care for our patients. I mean, if I'm not licensed in California and a patient travels there, do I risk criminal sanction in order to care for the patient, or do I risk malpractice by not caring for the patient in order to abide by California's telehealth?
Well, now it's the waiting game, as the case always is, in the hands of the Ninth Circuit right now. So stay tuned. Dr. Sean McBride, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you can learn more about McBride v. Lawson and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
The outdated and ineffective Jones Act is contributing to the rising cost of many goods, including gasoline. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Is your wallet strained as you fill up the tank? There's a lesser known but important factor at play. And President Trump just made strides last week to ease the pain at the pump by putting a pause on the Jones Act. The Jones Act is a century-old federal shipping law that mandates any goods transported between U.S. ports must travel on vessels that are American-built, American-owned, and American-crewed. While originally justified on national security grounds, the modern economic reality shows that the law functions as a protectionist barrier that restricts supply and raises costs across the economy. The domestic shipbuilding requirement has significantly reduced the number of eligible vessels. U.S.-built ships can cost several multiples more than those built abroad. The result is a constrained maritime market with fewer carriers and higher shipping costs. These costs are not absorbed by industry, but instead passed directly on to consumers and businesses. For a state like ours, this has direct implications. Despite being a major energy producer, the Jones Act distorts domestic energy distribution. In some cases, it is more cost-effective to import fuel from foreign countries than to transport it between U.S. ports. As a result, this outcome undermines both economic efficiency and energy security. Last week, President Trump's decision to extend a waiver of the Jones Act reflects an acknowledgement of those structural problems. The waiver temporarily allows non-compliant vessels to transport fuel and goods between U.S. ports, increasing available shipping capacity. In doing so, it reduces bottlenecks, improves supply chain flexibility, and helps stabilize prices, particularly in energy markets. This is a targeted, practical response to supply constraints and price pressures. However, the need for repeated waivers underscores a broader policy failure. A law that must be routinely suspended during periods of stress is a law that is not functioning effectively under normal conditions. Our grassroots activists have entered the policy debate to advocate for full repeal of the Jones Act, citing its role in raising costs and limiting competition. As highlighted in recent reporting, our grassroots activist position is that the law benefits a narrow set of protected maritime interests at the expense of consumers, workers, and broader economic growth. From a policy standpoint, the case for reform is straightforward. First, repeal would increase competition in domestic shipping markets, lowering transportation costs. Second, it would improve energy distribution efficiently, ensuring that domestically produced resources can reach U.S. markets without artificial barriers. Third, it would strengthen supply chain resilience by expanding the number of vessels available during emergencies rather than relying on temporary executive waivers. Finally, it would align U.S. maritime policy with broader free market principles, reducing government-imposed distortions and allowing market forces to allocate resources more effectively. The extended waiver provides immediate relief, particularly in the form of increased energy supply flexibility and potential cost reductions. More importantly, it provides a real-world demonstration of what happens when these restrictions are lifted: greater capacity, improved efficiency, and downward pressures on prices. For policymakers and advocates, the implication is clear. Temporary waivers should not substitute for structural reform. If the policy goal is lower costs, stronger energy security, and more resilient supply chain, then permanent repeal of the Jones Act is the most effective path forward. The good news? Congress can get to work today to repeal the Jones Act for good. Tell Congress, take a cue from President Trump and get to work to lower energy costs across the board. Head to AmericansForProsperity.org to learn more. This is Emily Bry, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WLLF-FM in Hermitage, WRXV-FM in State College, along with WCNS-AM in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal, plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. ¶¶